Hey, friends, I'm Lee Brown. This is Crazy Shit in Real Estate. And today's guest has the best name of any guest I've ever had. I mean, Benjamin Goodpasture. I honestly am fascinated by that name. And I had to, of course, quiz him if he's a Quaker, because that's where that idea came from a long time ago. But we actually then talk about some really interesting things in real estate investing, including a machete. I don't think I've had a machete on the show. So enjoy this conversation and I'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to Crazy Shit in Real Estate. You'll be amazed at all these wild but true situations that others have found themselves in. Because on this show, you'll hear uncensored, unbelievable stories from the world of real estate. I'm Lee Brown. Let's dive right in.
Thank you for being willing to come on the show here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I love your podcast.
And you have like the best last name ever. I mean, isn't that was like not the Pilgrims, who were the people in the early days that had those names?
The Quakers.
That's right. Is it a Quaker name?
No, I think it's like an English Scottish name, which is probably similar. But actually, we had someone come over from Switzerland, and their last name was like basically Gudenhor or something like that. It was some weird. It was like
that would be even more fun.
Yeah, it was like horse pasture, and then they're like, "I'm going to change it to good pasture instead."
I mean, because, you know, people could misconstrue that.
That's true. I don't think I pronounced it right. I was saying more like whore there.
It made it way more fun the way you pronounce it, like whore. So just going to point that out there.
Yeah.
All right. So tell me a little bit about you. Where are you located? What do you do in and around real estate? Give me some Benjamin stories.
Yeah. So I'm in Northern California in Redding. We're close to the Oregon border near Mount Shasta. So we're in a mountain town. Yeah. So I grew up doing construction in Virginia. So I'm originally from. My dad was a contractor, and I was out there on the roof every morning, you know, like 8-10 years old, cleaning up. Yep, exactly.
Real work.
Yep. Manual labor, a lot of that, building decks. So I did that every summer, and then went to college at App State University and studied construction management.
Nice. So,
yep. Love the mountains. Started climbing. I like to say I went to school for rock climbing. I wasn't that interested in school, but I did construction management because that's what I thought I was supposed to do. And then moved to Raleigh, North Carolina, and worked for a big builder. Was a project manager for Standard Pacific Homes, and got laid off right at 2008 when the recession happened. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me. That was the start of my entrepreneur journey. So
I love that. So I'm very curious about, anytime somebody says they're glad they got laid off, I think that's a different viewpoint than you tend to hear. And of course, the mainstream media is poisonous anyway, but yeah, they always want to take a story and make it worse than it is, instead of a story that looks like it's bad, but actually is the beginning and just a new journey. So would you think you'd still be working in new construction project management at this point had you not gotten laid off? I mean, if the markets had stayed just stable?
Right. I don't think so. I didn't really like the culture of the company and what it was all about. And I wasn't really interested in it, to be honest. I wasn't that into real estate or construction. It wasn't until I moved out to California. So I came out here and, you know, I did a ministry school, and it's kind of a leadership ministry thing, and for a couple of years. And then when I got married, we bought our first house. We did house hacking. So the upstairs, the main house, was a 3-2, and we fixed it up and put it on Airbnb, and then went downstairs, was a little small apartment, and we lived in it. And that's when I started seeing the beauty of real estate, when I'm like, wow, like, I'm making enough to cover my mortgage, my bills, and this $1,000 a month loan payment that I had for the down payment and for the remodel. And so I was like, this is incredible. I want to learn more about real estate. So that really kicked off my journey, because at the time I was actually owning a rock climbing gym. And so that was my main gig until, you know, I jumped all in. So
how did you talk your wife into house hacking your first house? Because, and for those of y'all that are new to the podcast or aren't super familiar with that term, essentially that's renting out rooms in your house. And so you'd find a 4-bedroom house, you live in one, rent 3 of them out. That's house hacking. And it's not like a duplex where you have 2 separate living units. It's essentially a shared living inside the same unit. And that's obviously a way that a lot of young people have made it work in an increasing cost environment. And obviously it works really well for people that are single. But when you're married, I'm so curious about this. Was she also interested in being super fiscally responsible, or was the house that expensive that y'all were nervous? Because that's it's different viewpoints have to come to an agreement on that.
Right. Yeah. You know, at the time we thought it was expensive. This was in 2015. It was $230,000. And I think we always think we're overpaying when we're buying something. And then you look back and it's like, oh man, that was nothing. And so luckily we had separation between us and the other unit. It was a single family house, but it was its own separate thing. But our bedroom was right below the kitchen. And so the noise was pretty bad. I was okay, but my wife is very sensitive to sound. It wasn't that great for her. So we ended up moving upstairs and renting out the downstairs, and then we moved to another house because the goal was for me was like, hey, this is going to be a rental someday. And so when we moved out, essentially we had a duplex. We had two units that were, you know, cash flowing. And so we bought our next property, but it was more of like a flip. You know, I went all in, big remodel, started gutting it. People were like, oh, you should tear down this wall. And I was like, all right, so let's tear out that wall. And then, oh, if I tore that out, I might as well tear this out. And yeah, it was a good time.
And obviously you knew what you were doing. It's so painful to me as a realtor and to all of my realtor friends when we go into a house where somebody decided to do those kinds of projects without the expertise. And maybe they watched YouTube, and we know very well when somebody knows what they're doing. And also when they do not know what they're doing, it's kind of painful. But that being said, do you still have that house, that original hacked house, or did you sell it?
I do. I still have it. That's been our best performing asset. I mean, right now we have a long-term like Airbnb person upstairs that's paying over $5,000 a month. And then downstairs we do it a midterm, you know, like a 30 night rental for nurses and stuff. We're getting $2,000 for that. So, I mean, after all expenses and property management, I'm getting like $6,000 a month on that, which is just crazy. My mortgage is only $1,500. So
when you have that extra cash flow, do you guys use that to buy more real estate, or are you chunking away at that principal so it'll be paid off?
Yeah, great question. So let me tell you more of my story so you'll know like kind of how I use my cash. So that was kind of a light bulb, ha-ha moment of like, man, this is amazing. And then we had a pretty bad fire here called the car fire. And so we ended up moving to Tahoe for a few months. And so we rented out our house that we were living in, and I actually bought two properties in Kansas City right at that time, which was pretty fun. And then I was just like, just soaking it up, listening to podcasts, reading books, just wanting more of this. And anyways, I was like, man, I want to start flipping. I want to do this. And so I ended up calling my brother. He's 10 years older than me, one of the best men I know. And I was telling him this, and he goes, well, that's interesting. I do hard money loans. And I was like, what's hard money? You know, I didn't really know what it was. And so he told me, and so I was like, okay, I'm gonna start looking for properties. I want to flip. And so in 19, found our first flip, and we flipped a house and did great. We ended up making about 40K on it. And then going into 2020, that's when COVID hit. And, you know, I'm running a rock climbing gym and we have to shut down.
In
California, we had to shut down for 2 months. And right at that time, I bought another flip, and then I bought our first multifamily. And that's when I was like, okay, so I had to shut the gym down. I'm like rehabbing in there and doing that sort of thing. And we just kept doing it in 2020. And I sold my gym that year and was able to get out. And then in 21, I went full-time real estate investing, buying flips and also doing the Burr method, if you're familiar with that, and buying multis and, you know, refinancing and keeping them. And right now we've got 45 doors and yeah, we're flipping houses and looking at bigger projects, that some new construction as well. So
the audience for my podcast is not just investors. There's also a lot of regular realtors that listen to the show and watch the show. So first of all, I want you to explain the Burr method, because a lot of our listeners aren't familiar with that. But second of all, I'd love for you to share, how in the world can you find something with a margin available to do a flip in an increasing market? Because even though we're recording this in July of 22 and the markets are stabilizing right now, yeah, the run-up has been so extreme. that a lot of our investors have had to kind of keep their powder dry waiting on some kind of economic change in the market. But it sounds like you're still out there finding some diamonds. Is that word of mouth? Are you doing tax sales? Are you wholesaling? What's your approach on finding properties?
Yeah. So I'll start with the BRRRR method. BRRRR is buy, renovate, rent, refinance, repeat. And so it's essentially like you're doing a fix and flip, but instead of selling it, you refinance and keep it as a rental, as a cash flow and asset. And it is by far the best strategy. Yeah. So we just finished refinancing two BRRRRs. One is a 16 unit apartment complex, which was four fourplexes. And so we bought the property for $1.2 million, which is really cheap for in Reading. And we got it on market. And I think it was listed for like 1.6. We got it for 1.25. We got it at a such a good price because we bought it cash. I used hard money. It looks like a cash offer. And there was a lot of vacancy, a lot of deferred maintenance. I mean, it was crazy. I mean, one unit had thousands and thousands of cockroaches. I mean, it was the nastiest unit I've ever seen.
So hang on. Where are these thousands of cockroaches? Are we like in Joe's apartment? You're kind of young. You might not remember Joe's apartment from MTV. Have you ever seen those old clips? I know you're going to have to look it up in the files of history. All of my medium age people remember this with me, but Joe's apartment was this series they ran on MTV, these little shorts, and Joe had an apartment full of cockroaches. So if he'd ever bring a girl over, they would like carry a beer to her. They have to hide when the light came on. He's talking to his cockroaches. They were his friends. And so anyway, there were thousands of cockroaches in Joe's apartment. So when you walked into this unit, where were they? Like in the cupboards and hiding, and you turned the light on and they scattered? Or
no, I'm talking everywhere. There's all over the ceiling. They're falling on your head when you're walking in. I mean, it was crazy. It was nasty. And so, yeah, it was pretty rough. We just finished fixing them up, renting them out, and just refinanced. And it's amazing. The property, the new value is over 2.6. We're able to cash out over $300,000. Like, I actually made money. As far as like our cash out, we only put in about $250,000. So I pulled out an extra $50,000 that was just built equity and enforced appreciation on it. So it was amazing. So we do those. We do them on some single family houses, but not as much because you can't control the value like you can on a commercial property. But as far as the market goes, we're finding stuff off market. We're sending out letters. We're doing that sort of thing. I would say 90% of my stuff has been on market. The stuff we've gotten off market have been through relationships. So I do a lot of social media. So branding, that sort of thing is key. So just letting people know, like, we're here and what we do, and realtors will come up to me. Like one time I was in a coffee shop and having a coffee, and then a realtor comes up to me and we start talking. She goes, "Hey, I just bought this property and it's got a duplex I want to sell downtown. Is that something you want to buy?" I'm like, "Yes, please." And so getting deals like that, but yeah, really trying to do more off-market deals. I think with this market, there's going to be a lot more on-market deals happening because people are putting their house for sale. You know, it's become more of a buyer's market. So I think we're going to see a lot of price reductions, more buyers. But as far as analyzing deals and getting good deals, I'm being really conservative, but also aggressive at the same time. Like, we're making lots of offers, but they're pretty much low balls.
Well, and I want to make sure we address one thing here for my regular realtors that are listening to this. If you work in residential real estate, single family homes, you're so used to a market that's above asking price and multiple offers. And you talk about a 16 unit like Benjamin's talking about, and that's a commercial loan. That's a different kind of loan altogether, but it's also valued differently. We don't value those on comps. You value that on the income of the property. And so a property that's got a lot of vacancies actually represents an opportunity because it should be priced below market if there's no tenants in there. But I know as an investor myself, I love a property that's got vacancies in it because then I can do the work that's needed to bring it up, but I can also select the tenants and let my property manager do the evaluation. So I'm not inheriting somebody else's Achilles heel, which happens sometimes. So I can't stress enough, if you're a residential realtor and this sounds interesting to you, you need to go get a mentor to learn this because it's an entirely different kind of real estate, but it's a wonderful opportunity, especially for building that long-term income. So you've got 45 doors now. What's the goal?
Yeah, my goal is, it's more of a cash flow goal. I would love to have about 150K a month in cash flow. So I think it's going to be probably 300 plus doors. I think that'll probably be about a $60 million net worth is kind of where I like to be. That's about $100 million in assets under management.
If you are remotely awake, then you know that we are heading into some really tricky economic times. We have home buyers that have put the kibosh on buying. We have sellers who have found out suddenly their houses aren't dipped in 14 karat gold. And as a realtor, you are still trying to keep up with the business you have and trying to answer questions in the meantime while also managing sky high fuel cost at the pump. Never fear, because my new video course is coming out right now, and it's called How to Dominate During a Recession. I've been a realtor for 22 years. My business went up every year during the Great Recession, and it's all because of education. This course is 4 modules. There might even be some bonus content for you. The price is $199. I am delighted to bring this out as quickly as possible because, friends, there's no time like the present to make sure our neighbors are stronger and we protect the American dream. Click on this link,
www.dominatethisrecession.com, and I'll see you there. Now, back to this amazing content.
Is that you with partners? Is that you and your wife as partnership?
Yeah, just me and my wife.
Very nice.
It's fun. I don't want to bring on another partner. You know, I already got one.
Well, you know, and the one you have is the community property, the one that's scripturally yours for life. So there's that too. So, all right, let's talk about the things you didn't expect to see in the business besides the cockroaches. Because, of course, on Crazy Shit in Real Estate, we like to look at the completely unexpected side of the business. I'd love to know, in evaluating properties and the different stages of real estate that you've been in, what's the scenario you encounter that you still can't believe you saw it and came through to the other side?
Yeah, I've got a great story. So it was my first multifamily. It's a 5-unit, really cool property. It's a fourplex and a single family house all in one lot. And I bought it from a broker friend of mine, and it was listed on MLS for $350, very low. I mean, it was just nasty. I mean, just very unattractive. The house was fully gutted. No one lived there. I mean, there was no kitchen. There was holes in the drywall. I actually bought it with the fourplex sight unseen. Didn't even walk in those units. And so that was kind of part of the deal. So my first time seeing the fourplex, I got a call from the fire department. And I go over there and there's fire trucks. And I go in this unit and there's like, the tenant called me too and was saying, hey, like the unit upstairs is flooding my unit. This is my first experience in this building. So I go upstairs and it is just nasty. I mean, just disgusting. And there it is. The shower is running. I can't even turn it off. And it is flooding the room downstairs. And so we got that tenant out and there was like 10 people living in a 3-bedroom. And it was just a nightmare.
Well, the one with the shower that you couldn't turn off, 10 people were living in there?
Yeah, it was bad. And so too many people living in there. We ended up getting them out. And so the plan on this whole property was to have the tenants move because there's so much deferred maintenance and so much work that needed to get done. We couldn't do it while they lived there. So I brought them all together. I had a guy come with me because there's some interesting tenants. And so we had a little meeting. I'm going to manage these myself. I was like, I got this. You know, I'm a good guy. I can do this.
No problem.
Yeah, no problem. I show up. One of the tenants had code enforcement there and talking about how I wasn't doing all this stuff. This is my first encounter with this guy. It was super intense. And next thing you know, these tenants were getting in fights and it was just crazy. And so pretty rough. And then it just kept escalating. I had this one tenant that just kept texting me probably hundreds of times every day, just crazy stuff. And so I offered a cash for keys, you know, a little assistance to have them move. And one tenant who's a little bit disabled was like, hey, like I'm willing to move, but I need a ride to Nevada. And I was like, all right, well, I'll give you a ride or I'll find somebody. And so it ended up being me that gave him a ride 4 hours to Nevada, moved him there. And it's actually a blessing in disguise because he moved in with his brother who he hasn't seen in 20 years. So that was really cool. But that other tenant that I told you about was pretty crazy. It got worse. Like he started harassing my subs that were working over there. He'd hit on the door with a machete. We started having to call the cops on him.
Is this the code enforcement guy?
This is the guy that called the code enforcement. Yeah, this tenant. And so I finally had to block his number. He started threatening me. And so I had to carry pepper spray because I was like, I'm going to throw down with this guy. He's going to, you know, and then I was hearing horror stories of like landlords getting shot.
Yeah, I mean, carrying pepper spray. The dude's got a machete, but just, you know, carry on.
Yes. I mean, I started getting a lot of fear, you know, because I'm hearing these stories of landlords getting murdered by tenants. And I'm like, this guy is lost it. Like he might be the person that would do this. And so this kept happening. And then he started spray painting stuff on my building, like vandalizing it and kind of like slandering my name. And then he started doing that on his van. He started putting like
on his own van? Making
on his own vehicle. He started spray painting, "I'm making Reading homeless," like all over his van, driving around town with like my name all over his van, almost like thinking, pretty sure I made it. I'm like a legit real estate investor. I'm pretty sure most people don't have this right now. So this is all happening. We're going to court. I'm trying to evict him. We went to court twice. Took about 8 months. And
because you're in California and California says he's in the right. Hello.
Yes. California is tough to be an investor. I don't know what I'm doing here sometimes. But we finally got him out and it was a nightmare. I was so stressed. And that was a big pivot for me. I'm like, I will not manage another property. I am going to hire property managers from here on. That was so stressful. Great learning curve. I mean, we learned a ton. We made money. It's a great asset, but it was painful.
I mean, the minute you said I can manage this, I'm a nice guy. I'm like, those are not the two sides of the same coin in property management, because as you know, 99% of your tenants are decent people who want to pay and have somewhere decent to live. And then the 1% is so insane and so over the top. A good property manager is, I mean, there's a reason they all chain smoke. Let's be honest. Most property managers are chain smokers, and I don't fault them at all, because they earn every penny they make on everything they manage on that one guy like you're talking about there. So I want to hear, though, a lot of our listeners are in other states, and obviously every state has its own landlord-tenant laws. And like North Carolina, where I am, it's a far more efficient process for eviction, with the exception of COVID. That's its own little moment in time. But in California, how was it that the courts found in favor of letting that tenant stay put when you have this kind of behavior and documentation too? It's not like you just made it up, so they can see what's going on. How did they find in favor of him staying?
Yeah, that's great. They're just so in favor of tenants. It's kind of crazy. What really hurt him was I offered him $3,000 to move, and he signed a mutual termination agreement.
Okay.
And so when he signed that, he was pretty much like didn't have much rights. And so, and he also took my money and didn't move out. Yeah. So he took the money and didn't move. So that's when we filed with the court. And that's what I think really made it the tipping point for the eviction. And then he moved out and he surprisingly didn't trash the place. I was really surprised, but I've got two evictions going on right now. One tenant hasn't paid rent in 8 months. You know, it's crazy. And the other one is just, I've been trying to evict them for a year. And it's really a sad situation because they can't really take care of themselves. They need some kind of like assisted living. But the problem that I have is their unit smells so bad. It's literally going throughout my building and people are moving out.
Yeah.
And so their legal services is fighting it. And they're like threatening some lawsuits with us, like discrimination. And so it's really messed up. So that's what's keeping them like in there. And so we're trying to find some kind of help, like social workers is just like, hey, let's find them like assisted living, because they clearly can't take care of themselves.
Well, I mean, there's a talk about a shortage. It's not just places to live, but that transitional housing piece, the group home piece for people that are, like you said, they just can't really take care of themselves and need some kind of assistance. It is a huge hole in the market, but I don't really know what the solution is going to be, as expensive as housing is now. And I'm not in favor of government intervention in everything, but there's got to be some kind of a public-private partnership that could be created, because people like that, if they're at risk with their health too.
No.
So it's not fair to them to leave them in a bad living situation, but it's also you can't damage everybody else at the same time. It's so wild.
Yeah. And you risk losing the property. You know, if people move out and you can't make a payment, like that's a lose-lose situation. No one wins.
And then everybody's out of housing, including those people that are legal aid is trying to say they should get to stay. So now everybody loses. I don't think that works.
No, it's not good. So yeah, it's exciting. Real estate's fun.
I mean, real estate's amazing. It's so many different angles to go in. And I think right now with the changes in the market, a lot of investors are getting excited again because there's going to be opportunities to go in and pick up properties that do need some rehab and do need some maintenance done and provide some more housing opportunities, because a dilapidated property really isn't helping anybody, as you've discovered. But then you fix it up, you win, and they got a better place to live, and everybody wins.
Absolutely. And I really believe there's deals in any market. In a buyer's market, a seller's market, there's always going to be deals. And I think as a wise investor, it's not about going in and out. It's about consistency. It's about staying in the market. And it's about holding long term. Holding long term, you're going to win. The values historically always go up. Rates come and go. Market economies come and go. But I think if you stay in it long enough, you're going to win. So, and I think one thing that's interesting is that the past couple of years, it's been such a hot market and investors are looking really good because of how much appreciation is happening. So as a flipper, you could be making mistakes, but the appreciation is covering up your tail end, because you might make a few mistakes, but with that appreciation, you're still making money. So if you're not making money and you're on the sideline when it's good, when it gets challenging, I don't think those people are going to like get in the game. So I think there's opportunity for people that investors that have been in for a while. I think there's going to be less buyers.
I think there will be a different group of buyers. The ones who haven't wanted to participate in the run up because it felt too aggressive and too over the top, they'll come back now because they would rather buy in a less exuberant market.
Yeah.
But like you said, you know, over time, the numbers tend to play out. Obviously, we never guaranteed anything goes up by any percentage in any market, but historically, houses go up. Just ask your parents what they paid for their first houses once upon a time, and you realize you wish you'd still have that house too. But so, Benjamin, if anybody's wanting to reach out to you to find out more about what you're doing with investing or to just connect, what's the best way for them to find you?
I'm on Instagram, so Benjamin Goodpasture on Instagram, and then we have a YouTube channel, Benjamin Goodpasture. Those are the best two ways to kind of find our content and learn more about real estate.
What's the one lesson you'd like to leave with people besides the fact that they should be involved in the market all the time consistently? So you've said that a couple of times. What's the other little tidbit you'd leave with people like yourself that are younger and wondering if this is something to mess with?
Yeah, I think if you're younger, I always say, I think house hacking is the easiest way to get in the game. And like you said before, it is a primary house and an investment in one. And it's just, you can get an FHA loan for 3.5%. And so it's very minimal down. You can also get a gift from a relative. And so maybe you get a loan, if you will, a gift from somebody, and that's how you can get in. And with rates so high, I mean, just having some kind of income on the property, your mortgage, rent, it's your highest expense. So if you're saving that every month, $1,000, $2,000, that's how you can get ahead and save up and buy your next property. And so oftentimes people are like, oh, I'm going to not go to Starbucks every day. You're saving maybe $200 a month. But when you're house hacking, you're learning how to manage a property. You're learning how to do your numbers. You're learning all these things that a real estate investor would, but under the safety of a low interest rate primary home and with a low down payment. So I'd say just buy that first property, house hack, and just learn the game.
And also stop drinking at Starbucks, because what a waste of money that is. And so that being said, thank you for coming on the show and for giving us insights and information. And guys, if you enjoyed what we learned from the Good Pasture here, make sure that you give him a nice comment and go visit his channels. I know that I'm going to go see what videos are over there and what I can learn myself. Thank you for coming over here on Crazy Shit, and I'll see you soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Leah.
As always, I'm so super thrilled that you joined in for more Crazy Shit. And if you're a realtor, investor, inspector, lender, or just a regular human being who happens to have an unbelievable story that you need to tell the world about, or frankly, you just need to one up the story you just heard, then make sure to DM me on Instagram @LeeThomasBrown or tweet me @LeeBrown or frankly, any social network where you hang out. I'm there. And if you had some fun, then you totally want to subscribe so you don't miss out on any future episodes.